The following is intended for mature audiences only. Discretion is advised.
Thank you so much for downloading this episode of So What Do You Really Do, the podcast where I, your host, Deader Dennis Maller, talks to artists and entertainers about their day jobs. And the artist and entertainer on the podcast today is Dr. Ellen Orkin. That's right. Finally have a medical professional on the podcast. That's all I've wanted since day one. Side note, Ken Jeong, you still have a open invitation to always be on this podcast. All right. Doesn't matter how many other doctors I have. I'm still aiming for you, sir. All right. Anyway, but no, Dr. Ellen Orkin, she's a psychiatrist and has a PhD. She is featured in the documentary By Day By Night, which we talked about. We talked to the producer and writer of it, Claudia, in a previous episode. And of course, we're going to be having some of the people featured in the documentary on the program in the next few episodes. And this is one of them. It was really great talking to Ellen. She has been in the comedy business almost as long as I've been around, in addition to also being a doctor for longer than that. So that is a rich history that we were able to dive into. It was fun. It was interesting. She has a lot of great stories. And you know what? We get into some heavy talk about some mental illness and mental health issues that are near and dear to my heart, or more accurately, more near and dear to my brain, because I suffer from a lot of them as well. So we do dive into that. So We will have a conversation about some of those issues. I will open up about some of my own, and I do go on quite a rant. If you enjoy my rants at times, this is the episode for you. So it was a good talk. She's been a comedian for a very long time as well, so she's had a rich history and a lot of interesting incidents and meetings that she talks about. So this is a really good, fun podcast to listen to, because this is what the podcast was supposed to be about: interesting day jobs and people who are entertaining some way, shape, or form by night. So please enjoy my conversation with psychiatrist and comedian Ellen Orkin. I was introduced to you as Ellen Orkin, and now, of course, doing research, and I got another email from you from a different account as Mousner. I'm like, who the hell is Ellen Mousner? So what's the first? Let's start with, as a man with a stage name, Dead Air Dennis, like Dead Air Dennis Mal, like Dead Air is not my legal name. It's an ironic nickname given to me because I work in radio and I never shut up. So that's why I have that stage name, but Maller's still my real last name. Did you hide your last name being on stage so you don't have to worry about patients or coworkers finding your comedy?
Yeah. So, and Ellen Orkin is my stage name, and Mousner is my legal last name.
All right. So when you started in, I'm sorry to say your age, because some people get weird about it. I don't think anyone should get weird about age. In fact, I think we should be more open about age so people don't get weird about age. But you started stand-up comedy, what, in the 80s, when I was born, which was the best time to do stand-up, I guess. Like, that was the late 70s and 80s comedy boom was a magical time for stand-up comedy. I remember watching stand-up comedy growing up, right? I saw it everywhere. It was on TV. Every talk show had stand-up comedy. TV shows were being made by stand-up comedians. You had stand-up comedy everywhere. And then in the 90s, whew, it all went away. So what got you? Let's start with stand-up comedy, and then we'll talk about your medical degree and stuff, because what was it like being in New York, the mecca of stand-up comedy, when that comedy boom happened? Was it, I'm going to jump into this brand new thing that's going on? Was it, oh, this is a hip thing, let's do this? Or did you not even notice how big stand-up comedy was to the world at the time that you were doing it and starting out?
Well, I was looking for a hobby. I'd always loved comedy, grew up on comedy. My parents watched the Ed Sullivan Show religiously on Sunday night at 8. And by religiously, I mean we faced Mecca. but you know, all those,
your TV was set towards the Wailing Wall.
That's right. And we had to stand and daven, you know, like prayers. But I mean, it was really, there was such, they loved comedy. They were funny people. I used to watch, we would sit down together. It was family time. It was happy time. And that got imprinted in here, you know, Joan Rivers, Alan King, Tody Fields, Jackie Mason, Stiller and Mira, all those wonderful comedians. And I remember as a kid watching a show, Soupy Sales was hilarious, and he had a lot of shtick. I remember growing up with that. And then I went to an academic, you know, phase where I did well in school, ended up college, applied to medical school, got into medical school. And at one point I realized that I needed a hobby that would take me off campus, something fun and completely not stressful, although, you know, we all know comedy has its adrenaline, but, you know, and I found this comedy class advertised on the back of the old Village Voice that used to be available on every street corner in one of those metal boxes, you know. And so I signed up for this course. It was taught by a lady named Lisa Carmel, and I loved it. I just loved it. And she said, well, you know, the class is one thing, but you got to get out every night and start hanging out at clubs. So I started going to a place called Good Times on 3rd Avenue and East 33rd Street in the Murray Hill neighborhood. And then I went to Catch a Rising Star. And I remember the bar scene there was very crowded. And, of course, the inner room, you had all the you had Jerry Seinfeld and Belzer and Adrian Tolsch was a comedian married to Bill Sheft, who used to work for Letterman. But anyway, one night I was just standing there hanging out at the bar and Robin Williams came in. And I said, I'm a psychiatrist, but I want to do stand-up. And he goes, he said something like, of course you are. And he started improvising. And he goes, my mother, my penis, my mother, my penis, my mother, my penis. Just like in this, just like, you know. But
So you knew it was a magical, pivotal time in the world of comedy when you're in it. You're like, here's freaking Robin Williams. Like, okay. You brought up a couple of interesting names, which I'm going to be honest with you. I hate having to ask this question. I want to live in a world where I don't have to ask, what's it like being a woman in comedy? Did you have female icons? But we have to, because I've had guests on the show who, or women who do, or comedians that were like, I never saw any women doing comedy growing up. I never saw a female comedian until I started doing comedy. That is a very real thing that a lot of comedians have told me, both on this podcast and off. But you mentioned, like, Stiller and Mira, Lisa Corey, the person that was your teacher. So you had female icons of comedy growing up. Like, to me, I didn't see a difference. Like, to me, growing up, I wanted to grow up to be Lucille Ball. Like, I thought what I saw her doing on TV was no different than what I wanted to do in my life. It didn't matter that she was a woman or not. But that is not the case for a lot of people. I mean, I grew up really deep into comedy and knowing what was going on out there. Like, I got into fistfights in the schoolyard defending Joan Rivers. So, like, I knew they're out there. So what other than who else throughout your formulation of stand-up?
Do you remember a comedian, Brett Butler?
Oh, yes, I remember Brett Butler. She had her own TV show.
She had her own sitcom, yes. Grace Under Fire. She was
I remember that show very well. She was fantastic. She was starting to make a comeback because she was a recurring character on The Walking Dead for a little while, and I was really hoping that her career was going to blossom back up.
And also Carol Leifer. This was I used to hang out, one of my hangouts, we call it networking. Hangouts. The old improv, the improvisation, which was on West 44th Street between 8th and 9th Avenue. It was, I think it was 358 West 44th. And anyway, the original.
Somebody is Google searching that address right
now.
Yeah,
that's the original improv founded by Bud Friedman and his wife was Silver Saunders Friedman, and they'd gotten divorced, and now she got the club, and she was presiding over there. And Carol Leifer was one of the strongest acts, brilliant female comic. I was told that she used to date Jerry Seinfeld and that she was the model for Elaine Benes in Seinfeld. Yep. And she is one of the first real stars, and she writes for, you know, award shows. You'll see her name in the credits for the Oscars and the all these things. She's a brilliant comedy writer and performer. It was also Carol Siskind, who's still performing, and Wendy Liebman, and Kathy Ladman, and Margaret Smith, and Joy Behar, who's on The View and has had a wonderful career on The View for so many years, was performing there on Wednesday nights, and I used to hang out with her. She used to be a school teacher in Brooklyn, near where I grew up. And
well, talking about Joy Behar, because I'm watching some of your clips. I'm going over your history and comedy, and you were on The View.
Yes, yes.
Now I not going to be calling out age. I saw the video. I looked down. It said posted 2 years ago. I'm like, this was not 2022.
No, no.
Like one of the judges on it was Jeff Ross, and he still had hair. So it was definitely a long time ago when you were on The View, I can't even think of how long The View has been on the air. Like, I know it feels like it's always been on, but then when you think about how long ago, it's like, it couldn't have been that long ago. But then you think about, like, I've almost always known The View has been around.
Yes, over 25 years. A few years ago, they had their 25th anniversary, so I don't know what the anniversary is.
That blows my mind that it was a 90s show. But then I got to think about, like, I was in middle school, high school when Rosie O'Donnell had her daytime talk show, and that was The View was because of Rosie, unofficially because of Rosie's talk show. Like, Rosie was doing so well, so the other was like, hey, let's do a tired talk show of women.
You are a young man.
Yeah, 42. Like, I was born in 81, just about when you were, hey, I need a hobby. When you were in college going, I need a hobby, I was going,
I could be changing your diapers at that point. But yeah, I was born in 81, 1881.
With The View, how did The View come along for you?
Was it
one of those, they put out a casting call and you got it? Was Joy like, hey, Ellen, we're doing this thing? Like, was there some friendship helping you get into that spot? It's a popular talking among women in industries of sending the elevator back down, breaking through the glass ceiling, helping your friends get up. If you get to the top of level, help your friends get up there.
She didn't get me on the show. The truth is they announced that they were having a segment called Hilarious Doctors. And yes. I sent in a tape and I got a call and I was thrilled to get on the show. And
and you deserve your spot. By the way, I don't want to point out, like, I was like, oh, did you get on there because you had a friend? No, you're a funny comedian. You earned your spot. But, I mean, I've done that where, like, I worked in music radio for many years. And when every time one of the radio stations I worked for did a band contest, I emailed every band. I was like, apply to this contest, you guys. Make sure you know about this. This will help your career. So, no, that's great. Like, so was The View your first TV performance?
I'd been on a few other things. A few years back, there was a show called America's Funniest People. It was on Sunday night. It was a Vin DiBona production. And they had it was one of those, clips that people send in funny clips.
Yeah.
And it's just a series of clips. And I did this thing, an impression of a TV set where I take a red vest, turn around, and then I come back and my hands are in that, it's framing my face like a television set. And they liked it and they used it in the opening credits. So that was a bit of luck. Sometimes you just get lucky. I was on a show, Oprah had a segment, Oprah no longer on the air, but she had a segment, Oprah's Funniest Viewers. And I sent in the thing and they aired it. So I was also on a show called PM Magazine, which goes back to like 1987, 88 maybe. Gary Hart. I hope I'm right. Rita Moreno was the guest. And I was on as the psychiatrist by day, comic by night. And Rita Moreno, we were doing the panel. Rita Moreno, she said, I've been in therapy, speaking about herself, and I'd be very uncomfortable if I heard that my psychiatrist was going out on stage. So then she laid down and she put her head in my lap, which was thrilling. I'm thinking is Rita Moreno's head is in my lap and her beautiful big hair. And, she was just saying, and then she was sort of, she's like, she was improvising with her head in my lap, saying as though she were in an analytics session, going like, "Doctor, are you getting up on stage making fun of me?" So she sort of was sort of, you know, becoming part of the interview, but it was thrilling. It was thrilling.
Excellent. So you have a good experience with TV. You grew up watching TV. One of the things I'm always curious about is because, again, someone who grew up in entertainment, someone who grew up watching TV all the time and also being involved in the entertainment industry, you know, as an act, like I always knew that TV was made by people. I always knew that there are jobs, you know, actors are jobs, comedians get paid. Like this is a entertainment industry. This isn't, you know, magic being made in front of you. So there's a lot of things like TV magic spoiled on me because I'm like, oh yeah, I already understand all that. Like there was never the moment where I was like, oh, I can make comedy a career. I was like, yes, it was already a thing that I knew. Was that something that when you started doing stand up and started getting some of these earlier TV spots on things, was there still that magic of you like, oh my God, this is my dreams coming true? Whereas me in my head, I'm like, I'm a comedian. I should be on TV. Like I should have these segments. You should bring me on to these things because that is what the job is. Or did you still hold on to that dream of that this is a fantasy world, that these are dreams come true?
It's funny. You know, I always felt a certain thrill. I mean, it's a business. It's technical. It's political. You know, we know it's an industry. But for me, the thrill of television, the thrill of reaching all those people, all those little people in the dark, Norma Desmond, just, I don't know, just, it still seems magical to me and remarkable, but I'm down to earth, you know, I still aspire to, I sure would love to do a late night spot on Colbert or Fallon or Myers or any of those, you know. I also was on The Sopranos playing a psychiatrist.
Wait, yeah, I saw that and I was like, I mean, typecasting? Like, come on. Like, hey, we need a psychiatrist to play a psychiatrist. Like, look, Ellen's got range. She can do something else. How was it working on Sopranos?
Oh, it was, talk about thrills. I was already a fan of the show. So to go to Silver Cup Studio in Long Island City and go to the studio, and I was there for 3 days. The first day is a wardrobe fitting, and they take such pains to try different. I was playing a psychiatrist, so they, you know, they took out all these suits, and I had brought a watch and a suitcase, and they go, no, 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 you don't bring your stuff.
Oh, see, my experience with acting is the exact opposite because I do mostly background. So it's like, hey, bring your own clothes, and if we don't like them, we're going to send you home. So make sure you bring options.
Right,
I've
right.
I've on the set with so many, like,
exactly.
The hanging suit,
yes,
things where it's like, please like something on this. I need this money.
That's right, and you get paid for extra changes of wardrobe and all that. I bought all my stuff because I've done a lot of background work, but they just said, and they brought out trays, velvet trays of watches and earrings, and they're holding up the earrings. And I kept thinking, I have one scene, and look at the care and attention to detail. The atmosphere was charged. It felt like everybody was on their A game. Everyone felt they were trying to do their best. And then you get to the set, and we had a rehearsal. And I even had my own little dressing room for a few hours with my name on the door and my character's name, Dr. Sharon Zalutsky. What a stretch.
Like, you know what? We need to play this Jewish doctor, a Jewish doctor.
I even went to medical school to prepare for this role. Talk about method acting. Commitment. I'm not phoning this in.
Daniel Day-Lewis, if you didn't go through 8 years of school and $250,000 dollars in student loan debt, then you really should have quit acting, you hack.
That's right. That's right. No, I was very lucky. I had also prepared for it. I prepared my audition. And then when I got the call back, I wore my badge from my day job, from my hospital job, with my little photo ID. And David Chase, who's the genius creator of the series and the other writers, he said to me, "What's that badge?" I said, "Well, I'm a psychiatrist in real life, but I'd rather play one on TV." And that got a chuckle. So I thought, because otherwise there would not have been a moment to mention that. And I thought, let me mention that, for goodness sakes. New York being a very, you know, it's a very competitive place. And there were a lot of other people auditioning, but I was thrilled to get the part. And then we have the shoot, and I'm doing the scene with Dominic Chianese, who plays Uncle Junior. And the scene is, I'm playing a court-appointed psychiatrist who's interviewing him to see if he's mentally fit to stand trial, because he's claiming to be Ubats, like Jimmy the Chin. Do you remember? I don't know. There was a Jimmy the Chin Gigante who would wander around the village in a bathrobe because he wanted to convince people he had dementia and therefore could not stand trial. That was loosely based on that. But anyway, but the episode was called Whoever Did This, episode number 48 from the fourth season. And you can get that clip on YouTube if you just type in Ellen Orchid, The Sopranos, or you'll see my scene interviewing Uncle Junior. And I was doing what they call a mental status exam. And I go, I'm going to say three words, and I want you to repeat them. Boat, flag, shirt. And he's pretending to be confused. So he's going, boat,
flag, shirt.
Boat, flag. I want to go to the bathroom. So he's trying to, anyway, it was thrilling. And we did 26 takes of that scene, that interview. Oh. And it's all of one.
Why?
It's a lot
Why?
Of fun. I know. I'm just telling you the level, the standards. The first 22 were word for word. And then they said, you want to improvise a little bit. So they gave us a little room to play. We tried some of that. And
did you find it, as the expert in the room, did you find it hard to not go, a real psychiatrist wouldn't say this? Or act, well, actually, did you have to stop yourself from those moments? Because I can't stop myself from doing a well, actually. That's probably why I get myself in a lot of trouble.
To be honest, I was so thrilled to be there and so eager to please that I would have, it would have taken something out really outrageous for me to say anything. So I was very happy to be there and happy to do it. And the way they edited it, it's very exciting. You see the reaction of Tony's sister. She's like rolling her eyes when she realizes what Junior's doing. She's going like, it's great fun. And it's just a wonderful, thrilling experience. Those sets are so elaborate. Like, they had a restaurant set there. And when you walk on the soundstage, you see these huge rooms, the detail, it really, the money and the detail and the appointments, the decor is just so elaborate. It's chandeliers and table settings and everything about it. The scene that I did was in Uncle Junior's kitchen. And look at the wallpaper and the tchotchkes on the, it really looks like an Italian kitchen in New Jersey, lived in, real, the authentic. And between every take, someone would come over and like act busy, like they're doing their job, tweaking my hair. And
doing checkups.
Right. It was almost as if everyone was really concerned that they'd be doing their job. And you felt that stakes were high and we wanted it to be just right.
Excellent. So let's start talking about your foray. Well, before we get into foray, was the magic of entertainment wasted on you because you grew up in an entertainment family? Like, wasn't your grandfather a musical composer? Did you grow up in a family of entertainers? Are you just another person following in the line of the family legacy, the family business is to be entertaining?
Yes. My grandfather was Jacob Weinberg, who was a Russian immigrant to this country. And he had studied at the Moscow Conservatory from 1901 to 1906 and got a PhD in music. He had also gone to law school because his parents didn't think music had a future financially, and he needed to be, right? He did complete law school, but he didn't want to be a lawyer, and he followed his dream of performing classical piano and composing. And he's composed over 137 works that are registered with ASCAP now, classical works, concertos, sonatas, quartets, quintets, and some of the music is still being performed. And if you go on YouTube again and put in Jacob Weinberg, W-E-I-N-B-E-R-G, Jacob, J-A-C-O-B, you'll see some of his compositions. The music is beautiful. He has one thing, sonata for two pianos. He wrote a piece for two pianos. And, you know, a piano alone can be quite beautiful, but you have two. The combination, beautiful works. He was an entertainer in the sense he played Carnegie Hall. He played the 92nd Street Y, Town Hall, what's now City Center, a lot of the institutions around the city of Manhattan. And he taught at Hunter College in the music department. He passed away in 1956. Was it 56 or 57? And my father, who was also a pianist, and not a concert level pianist, but a very capable pianist who taught piano and performed with several bands and orchestras professionally. He also played accordion. He also played the organ, which has, you know, several keyboards and stops and all kinds of gadgets. And he made his living that way.
So the family line of performing has been following through all the way down to you even as well.
Yes.
Excellent. And so were you encouraged when you started doing stand-up? Were you encouraged by your parents who were like, hey, look, if granddad could make a living as a performer and dad makes a living as a performer, yeah, you can go out and make a living as a performer too. Were your parents supportive?
My parents were concerned that this was a mistake, that if it got out that I was doing this, I would lose credibility as a professional. And my mother was worried, and I felt bad for her. She would say, like, you know, what if one of your patients walks in and sees you on stage? And I'm thinking, I hope they'll laugh. and it, you know, sometimes people over the years have Googled my name and seen comedy clips. And I've had patients come in and say, oh, I heard you do comedy. I've got a great joke for you.
The dreaded response of, oh, you do comedy? Here, let me tell you comedy. Oh,
right. So nobody ever said, I don't trust you, or I don't think you're going to be a good doctor, because I am a good doctor, and I worked very hard. And but if colleagues found out, once in a while, a colleague would say, come over here. Didn't I see you on YouTube doing this joke? And that, I said, yeah, I do this, but I don't really, you know, talk about it at work. And people were intrigued, and sometimes they felt like it was nice. It's like they said, you're following your dreams. Good for you. You're doing something fun. You're funny. You're talented. So it never really didn't. I don't perceive it as something that did me harm, but it is something I'm concerned about. And I make, you know, I don't make fun of any of patients in my act. I don't make fun of mental illness. God knows, nothing like that. So people that know me have accepted me. You know.
Well, that's good. And then, so talking about being a good professional doctor, it came from having to go to school for this. So what was the, what got you into psychiatry? Because some people live, they get into the medical profession because they live with somebody that had a medical issue, or they had some kind of medical issue growing up, and they're like, oh, I want to help find a cause for this. Or they knew somebody that did. They're like, I want to help other people, because I couldn't help so-and-so. Or some people just get pushed into that medical field because, like, oh, we got to be a doctor. You got to grow up to be a doctor. So, like, all right, I'll go to med school and become a psychiatrist. What led young Ellen into the medical professional field?
Well, you know, I always liked science. And I won the New York City Science Fair for the borough of Brooklyn in 1968. I had a really cool project, and it actually won for the borough of
Brooklyn. What was the project?
It was called Are a Mouse's Whiskers, you know, whiskers, related to its sense of direction?
Huh.
And it turns out that animals with whiskers, like mice, cats, the whiskers are connected to a part of the brain called the superior colliculus, which is connected to the eyes. And it's a long story short. In the dark, a lot of these animals are nocturnal and they need to see in the dark, but because there's no light, they feel their way with the whiskers, which are technically called vibrissae, V-I-B-R-I-S-S-A or something like that. Each whisker is attached to a cell, a receptor cell, a sensory cell that sends a signal to that part of the brain that's interpreted visually. So an animal can find its way. We had mice, and some of them, we clipped their whiskers. We didn't hurt them. Hope.
It was a different time. Guilt. Like, PETA wasn't around as much. It's fine.
Anyway, we clipped the whiskers on one side, and they would not be able to find their way on that side because they couldn't feel the surface of the wall. They could feel the wall with the left side. And then we had a few mice that we clipped the whiskers on both sides, and they couldn't make any headway into the maze. They didn't get very far at all. We had this maze that was covered with red cellophane to block the light. And we timed them, the different mice that had different arrangements of whiskers, how long it took them to get through the maze. And the ones that had a full set did fine. The ones that had only half a set took much longer, and the ones with none didn't get very far at all.
So how old were you when you did this test?
14.
What? 14. I was walking around Camden Yards, at Oreo Park at Camden Yards, with a tray full of lemonade, screaming, "Lemonade, here, come get your lemonade," and not able to paint my baking soda volcano. Like, how did you do an entire animal experiment at 14?
Well, you know, our teachers helped us a lot, the biology teachers. Let's be honest, the teachers helped us a lot. No one does it alone. As they say at the Oscars, no one does it alone. It's a team. It's a collaboration. My mother, my marvelous, brilliant mother, let me have a terrarium or a glass case full of white lab mice, those mice with the pink eyes. God bless her. She was a meticulous housewife. And that she would allow this to be in the house with a cover, of course. You know, I know she wasn't thrilled about that, but we had to keep them somewhere at night or on the holidays, on the weekends, and feed them. We couldn't leave them overnight at school or on the weekends, rather. But anyway, she was ambitious for me, and we won. And the prize was a set of the World Book Encyclopedia. Remember the world? You may be too young. Now it's all online, but we used to have these encyclopedias. You know, so I was good in science and I got good grades and I studied all the time. I was a real nerd. And as I say in my act, my parents not only helped me with my homework, they sent me to Kaplan's. I don't know if you remember Kaplan's, you know, the tutoring school where you test prep. Yep. I am so old that my teacher was Stanley H. Kaplan, the guy who founded the company.
Ah, wow. I mean, at least you're getting the best help.
Like learning Hebrew from Moses, I'm telling you. I was very lucky. I had great teachers. I was ambitious, and then I ended up getting into a good college, and I went to medical school. I went to Albert Einstein.
What college did you go to?
I went to a small women's college called Goucher College.
In Maryland?
In Towson, Maryland. That's right.
Yep. Oh, I'm from Baltimore originally. I may live in Boston now, but I am well from I went on one-night stands with a lot of women from Goucher in my early 20s. So, why Goucher, though?
I got a full scholarship.
Okay, there you go. The school that'll pay for it is the one you go to. I like that.
It helped. It helped a lot. My parents were not very affluent, but we were. And it was a beautiful school, a smallish, small campus. It was at the time, it was all women. Now it's co-ed. It used to be the sister school of Johns Hopkins. Mm-hmm. And I used to take the shuttle bus into Baltimore and study in the library at Johns Hopkins.
Oh, so what was? Oh, I get someone else's perspective than my dad's on what Baltimore in the 70s was like.
And we went
You just moved from New York. Like, you grew up in New York.
Yeah,
New York City.
Yeah.
What was it like being in a college away from your family for the first time in an unknown city, 200 miles away? Growing up in a completely different environment, like, what was the
Okay, I'll tell you. Okay.
For younger, what was the comparison of like New York City 70s to Baltimore?
Okay, well, the pace on the campus, this in this sort of a suburban or almost rural atmosphere, the pace was so much slower than I was used to. I heard silence for the first time. I had never heard silence before. I was like, what is that? It's like this pulsating on my eardrums. It's silence. We grew up next to the F train at McDonald Avenue. And after a while, you're so used to the subway, L, you don't, you know, it becomes part of the background noise. I saw moonlight for the first time in my life. In my life, I saw moonlight. And I thought, wow, how come, where are the streetlights? There's no streetlights. Why is it so bright? I even have a shadow. Damn, it's the moon. And, you know, really, going from the city to the country, we made fresh air. Who knew?
I mean, nowadays, Towson is still suburban, but it's a lot more busier than it was in the 1970s. 1970s, it was wide open space in Towson. Same thing if you go the farther north you go past Baltimore, the more open and rural it gets. And even though now they're full-on bustling communities and whatnot. But yeah, in the 1970s, Towson area was
yes
at night. Yes. Yeah. Now you can't. Now you won't hear crickets in Towson, but
only during my act. No, never. I kid.
So that was a pretty big change going from there to you. What going into Baltimore City proper though, was that more familiar to you? Because it was, you know, taller buildings, closer streets, more hustle and bustle. Was that more comfortable for you when you
yes, it was.
As you go down?
And I liked Baltimore. We used to go to a place called O'Brickey's, where they had the soft shell crabs that you'd break with a hammer. Delicious.
They're still around. They've expanded. They're in the airport now.
Oh,
they have the,
really?
But their crabs are lemon pepper crabs, and it's not Old Bay seasoning, so it's not traditional crabs, but it's close enough.
And the harbor front was beautiful.
Oh, you were there pre the renovation of the early 80s. Yeah. Oh, that was a completely different area, too. Oh, see, I only know it, again, born in 81. I only know the harbor of when it is now, back before.
Right. They just,
I don't know anything of the harbor area being just warehouses. And.
Yeah, they had the harbor. It was, you know, being completed and polished up. It was relatively new, if memory serves, but it was beautiful. And there's an aquarium there and a wonderful theater and a lot to do. And going to Hopkins, you could go to Hopkins and hear lectures. I remember going there to hear Jane Fonda speak. And very, you know, the feminist movement, she was always speaking and lecturing and very impressive.
So did you, growing up as someone who is in the sciences and in the medical field as a woman, felt that you were not welcomed among some of your other cohorts?
Not really.
Okay, that's good.
I felt I never had anybody block my path. If I was willing to work hard, I felt that things worked out for me. When I applied to medical school, in the application, there was another program advertised. It was called the Medical Scientist Training Program, which would take 6 years, but you would get your MD and a PhD, and it was funded by the federal government, and it was completely tuition-free, and you would get both degrees. So I applied for that, and they picked seven people out of 700 applicants, and of those seven, two were women, and I was one of them. And I did it. I got both degrees. It took me 7 years, not six, but at least I finished.
There's a lot of sevens in that story. 700 out of 700 people, seven were picked, and one of them worked for 7 years to get her degree.
You know, I'll tell you.
Seven's your lucky number.
Yes, I think so. When you go to medical school, if you do your homework, if you memorize and you pass your tests, and perform and show up, you will get through it. You know, if you're respectful and you show up, take all your tests, you will get through it. It's mostly a lot of memorizing and delivering the information on exams, and then you do your clinical work. But to get a PhD, you have to do research. And there's really no guarantee that you're going to have anything that works out. Your experiments may not work. You may have nothing to report. So it only mentioned that in the sense that in many ways, that was the harder degree to get. It took longer.
Well,
anyway,
seeing as PhDs run in your family, why did you decide on psychology? You're going to medical school. Why did you decide to take the psychological path?
Yeah. Well, you know, in medical school, you get exposed. The first 2 years are called the basic sciences, and it's all classroom work. You don't touch patients. You don't meet patients until the third and the last 2 years. But you get exposed to all the different specialties, internal medicine, that's all your bread and butter conditions, hypertension, diabetes, everything, surgery, OBGYN, pediatrics, radiology, psychiatry. You have, coursework. And I found the psychiatry stuff the most fun and interesting to read, the descriptions of the cases and the descriptions of the conditions. I really knew very little about schizophrenia or bipolar. It didn't touch my family or my neighbors or, you know, in our personal life. My awareness of mental illness, I mean, anxiety, sure. Depression, sure, touches everybody's lives. My family, we had that, relatives, neighbors, common. But these more unusual disturbances I had never really encountered. I wish they would teach more of this basic stuff in the public school so that people are more familiar with it. But anyway, I found it very interesting. And the medications that they use to treat these, the neurotransmitters, you know, the dopamine and serotonin, things that used to be understood in a very analytic way were now being interpreted in terms of brain chemistry. And the field is always growing. I just found the whole field fascinating, and I love doing the reading. The other stuff like dermatology, pediatrics, it was a little drier for me.
Hmm. And also for someone in the field of psychiatry, this is the late 70s. A lot of these discoveries were pretty new discoveries at the time. Like, we kind of just forget, like, we're still creating new understandings about the human brain, why certain things happen. And like, we're learning, we still don't know if alcoholism is caused by a gene or is it caused because of trauma and stuff like that. Like, we're still within a couple years of discovering some of these things. So in the mid to late 70s, when you were going to school and learning these things, I can't imagine that, you know, I have to imagine that it was kind of exciting just discovering a whole new field of medicine.
It's very exciting, very exciting. But things constantly evolve. Some of the medications that were commonly used when I was beginning my training, not used anymore because of, you know, experience in the world. They found side effects and negative things happening. It's a constantly growing field. It's
interesting. What are some of the biggest differences between psychology, the understanding of psychology in the late 70s, early 80s to now in 2024?
Well, there have been a lot of research done on the brain. The plasticity of the brain, you know, the brain has turned out to be more changeable than we used to think in terms of the plasticity, I mean, like new things, offshoots can grow. It's just constantly changing. There are PET scans and, you know, first there were only CAT scans, then there's MRIs, then there's PET scans, then there's SPECT scans and nuclear medicine. There are new tools to study these things. Medications have been introduced that are more effective and with fewer side effects than the old ones. And a lot of things we used that were our standard of care no longer being used because of things that have emerged. There's new therapies. For example, not so new, but dialectical behavioral therapy or DBT is very popular now, and a lot of people take advantage. We didn't have that in the 70s.
Yeah.
We were just beginning to have what's called cognitive behavioral therapy, where you would look at your thought processes. Are you doing black and white, black or white thinking, or are you overgeneralizing? And you start to, you know, mindfulness is another thing that people are using much more commonly as a tool. So many changes, and things like ketamine.
All right, I'm curious to hear your opinion on the ketamine study. Do you think it's still too early to have a definitive idea of where it works? Because I'm going to say, I think it's mumbo jumbo. I think ketamine therapy for treating it, I don't think that's going to work. But same thing with like the people are like, oh, microdosing and stuff like that. That doesn't, but also I went 6 years at community college and didn't graduate. So I'm a dummy. So you're the expert in the field. You're more than welcome to tell me is like there's promising things or what is the, you know, different drug therapy.
Well, I've had patients who on their own have signed up for ketamine infusions. And I did not refer them to that, but they, people who have experienced a lot of trauma, trauma, abuse, sexual abuse, verbal abuse, and loss, and very, you know, have reported to me that they find it very helpful. But you have to be careful. If you're on certain medications, like what they call the benzodiazepines, common things like Xanax, Klonopin, Ativan, you have to be let the people know there are interactions that you want to avoid. But this person has had a series of ketamine treatments and said that it really helps sort of dissociate her memories from the pain attached to them. And people are using, you know, these hallucinogenic mushrooms. I don't know. I'm curious and fascinated and also a little wary because we used to be taught never be the first person to use something new, you know, but people are having a variety of experiences. And, you know, you just want to be cautious and just keep the communication open. And if I would say, you know, proceed with caution.
Well, this may not be your area of expertise, but I think a lot of the like apprehensions with these treatment is because we can't do actual studies on it because federally these are illegal narcotics. And so we can't do subject tested field evidence, peer reviewed stuff. So is there, are you a proponent for not necessarily lobbying, but are you someone who is like, I'm in favor of legalizing these things just so we can actually find out whether it's true or not?
I think testing would be a very good thing. I mean, we got to, yeah, absolutely. I, you know, the more testing, the more knowledge, the better.
Is there any conversations like that in the medical, amongst the medical community people where they're like, hey, we got to find a way to make this stuff legal? Because if this is a potential way of treating people that we've never been able to, we have to find a way to get Congress, FDA, whomever, behind letting us test these things. Is that a conversation that's being had in the medical journals?
Well, the testing is very important. And, you know, testing can be expensive. You have to hire people to do it. You have to select subjects, evaluate the subjects, screen the subjects. It's labor intensive, time intensive. So you have to have resources to provide the funding for it. But I think these things should be all tested, all of it. And
you need to have a mother who's willing to let you have a giant terrarium full of white rats run around the living room.
The more we know about these things, the better.
Excellent. So over your years of as a medical professional, was it necessary for you to find a way to relieve some of the heaviness that you would be dealing with every day? Is that what drew you to comedy as needing to find a hobby?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. You know, you're exposed to people's histories and all the sadness and all the emotions, and you have to be tough and stay professional. But at the end of the day, it's hard to shake it off. And to have a hobby where you go to a club and it's lighthearted and fun and people are funny and creative and the stakes are, it's not life and death anymore. You know, you don't need malpractice insurance. Let me write that down. That's pretty funny. Yeah, the comedy malpractice, you know, someone boos you off the stage. Yeah, it's all you don't have. Nobody's been sued for not being funny. But anyway, it also gave me a chance to use another part of my brain, my personality, and to be funny. I was always a funny person, but didn't always have an outlet for it. In medical school, I remember we took a class, Gross Anatomy, and there was a skeleton hanging at the back of the room, and I would come in early and like put cigarettes in its mouth, put lingerie on it. I don't know. Nobody was amused.
Yeah, you sound like the kind of prankster I was, where like I, removed the hinges from my creative writing teacher's door. So when she opened it up after class, it fell down and scared her. Unbeknownst to me, though, it gave her an aneurysm, and then we never saw her again. So,
wow.
Yeah, well, I was a monster growing up. That's.
But what
I made a nun so mad she slapped me in the face because I wouldn't stop singing the lyrics to Fiddler on the Roof during Catholic school.
That is not. She should not have been slapping anybody. I'm so sorry. Sorry about that.
No, I brought it on myself, but I'm sure having somewhere to go to keep the mind busy instead of sitting alone in the dark, dwelling on everything, was incredibly helpful for you.
That's right.
Is there creating a hobby or creating a for lack of a better word, a distraction? Was that also maybe something that you used to help some of your patients? Was that something that you saw helped you and were able to pass that along during your therapy?
Well, you have to be careful with, I'm always concerned about what I'm saying and how it might be misunderstood, and people in distress, which was like everybody.
Yeah, no one's coming to you because they're having a great day.
including the staff. The sense of humor was not front of mind, but I often have said to patients, doing an evaluation, I say, what do you do for fun? What makes you happy? If you go on YouTube, what draws your eye? What cheers you up? And they'll talk a bit of, they may have been so blue, they haven't thought about that in a long time. I said, when you were a kid, what made you happy? What hobbies or interests did you have? And then I would say, there's a lot of free content on YouTube, comedy. I'd even say Joan Rivers. These things, you just get into a different frame of mind. It will put you a reset. It'll put you in a lighter frame of mind. It may be not at first, but give yourself a break from the things you're thinking about, from what you're going through. Do it regularly. I don't steer them to my act.
Yeah, you don't want the competition.
No. No, but I just say, laughter is very important. It's a great coping mechanism. And we forget that when we have carrying the weight of the world or we're grieving a death or something, we don't feel like we should be happy. But I say, now's the time to heal and take very good care of yourself. And humor is a wonderful way to take care of yourself. And then
in this stage, it seems like there's a lot more people who are in need of therapy. More than probably when I was younger, it seemed. Do you think, in your professional opinion, that is because people are in need of more therapy? Or is it because we are now better able to diagnose these issues and we're removing the stigma that used to be attached to seeing a therapist? So is the increase in therapy this day because more people need therapy or we're recognizing more people needing it?
Excellent question. I think it's both. I think because of the more open dialogues about mental illness, it's reducing the stigma, which is fantastic. And we have to talk about these things. That's the first step. Knowing that you're not alone, knowing your condition has a name, knowing that there are chat rooms and websites and you can discuss it, that you should, there's nothing to be ashamed about any more than you'd be ashamed about having diabetes or an ingrown toenail, And then also the pandemic, when people had to be isolated, it took a real toll on people's energy and minds. Being alone in a home or even with loved ones, but not being able to go out, people became more anxious, more ruminations, with less stimulation of going out to work and walking around the block and seeing your colleagues at work, working remotely, you see a lot more anxiety, depression, obsessing about the past, decreased confidence. A lot of people thinking they might have ADHD when they really don't, but it's just because they're alone with their devices for so many hours at a time that they're pulled in many directions and they having trouble focusing.
Yeah, someone who I do not believe I have ADHD. I never have. I've never been diagnosed with it. I don't even think there's a cause for it for me, but I do know and have been diagnosed with obsessive compulsive disorder. So, by the way, as someone who lives with mental illness, having the open dialogue about mental illness and mental health is very, very close to my heart. So, like, you can't talk about it enough. I'm so glad to be talking to someone who is a professional in the field openly and also wants. But my biggest gripe is how lightly we as a society take especially OCD. Like, I've written a whole joke about somebody going, oh, I have OCD. I have to make sure the pictures are straight. And then my reply is like, I was late because I can't step on shadows. Like, we're not the same thing. So it's like having that open dialogue of what is very important about OCD. Like, I don't know if you noticed it, but there's been a big, huge recent usage of the term letting your intrusive thoughts win. Like, that's become kind of a meme and kind of a joke. And I'm like, you know, like, so I'll see a TikTok that has the label, oh, my dog let his intrusive thoughts win. And it's him chasing the cat through the house. And I'm like, yeah, when my intrusive thoughts win, it means suicide for me. So please stop taking this lightly as a joke that intrusive thoughts are some kind of, you know, humorous thing. And, you know, it's.
I hear you. No, there's nothing funny about that. Nothing funny.
Yeah, certain disorders that we have that we take so lightly, and it drives me nuts. That's all. I just wanted to vet. Thank you. Should I have
you.
Do I owe you now a copay for that?
This is very
two
helpful.
Minute rant.
Very helpful. There's nothing more painful. OCD is an extremely painful condition. You know,
I'm lucky. Mine is manageable, but there are people who are not manageable about it. And then other people's like, oh my God, I have OCD. And it's like, no, you don't. You don't understand. As someone who's a part of that field,
you
sometimes see this lightheartedness about certain conditions. And does it also bother you?
It betrays that they don't really understand that it's a range. You know, you can have a mild symptoms, medium symptoms, and all the way to the most excruciating, debilitating. You know, I have had patients that had lost jobs because they couldn't stop washing their hands or counting the fringes on a rug and couldn't stop checking the stove. I mean, it's a matter of degree, but it can ruin your life, and it needs to be treated and respected. So people should not there's nothing funny about it. A person's lucky if they just have a mild little touch of it. You know, they're even doing surgery on the most severe cases that are so disabling that they're doing brain surgery to certain parts of the brain to try to destroy those fibers and give the person some relief.
Oh my, I didn't even know there was
there
was an option out there.
It is
but of course I shaved my head, so I don't want scars. So I'll stick with managing it the way I am now, which is going on rants and selling coffee mugs. I joke. I have this merch that I sell. It's hard to see in the camera, but it says "Not until I've had my coffee," and coffee is scratched out and says "antidepressants."
That's great. That's great.
It's the best way to let your coworkers know you live with mental illness,
which is so common and pervasive all over the world. And thank God we have some of the medications we have that didn't exist. You know, imagine all the pain and suffering of the last, you know, millennia, because they didn't have any way to treat these things.
Yeah. Or how many of these things 80 years ago was thought of to be someone being wrong, or they possessed by the devil.
That's
for
right.
God's sake.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's
We're
right.
not that far away from.
No.
Like, your grandfather lived during the time where somebody had schizophrenia. They're like, oh, he's possessed by the devil, let's throw water at him and tie him to a bed while we slap him in the face and read the Bible at him. Like,
it's
that was
true.
Clearly
it's
within
true.
A very...
You are so right. In, you know, at Bellevue Hospital, where I trained, they told us that in the 30s and 40s, they would hose disturbed patients, schizophrenic patients, with cold, cold water to calm them, to stop them. It's barbaric now when you think about it. Terrible things. They used to put people into comas with excessive doses of insulin. They really didn't have medications that worked. Or in England, they'd give them laudanum, like opiate concoctions that would calm them down, but certainly not a cure. Things have come a long way and we still need better medications that work faster and have fewer side effects. And they're still having things like transcranial magnetic stimulation, something called TMS, that's supposed to help people who don't respond to antidepressants. They're coming out with all kinds of things, but mental health, you know, the research, we just need better products, faster, safer, everything, all the research we can get, we need.
It sounds like with someone who, with your level of intelligence, with someone who has the work ethic that you, you grew up with in a family of immigrants, it's very well known that work ethic is passed along with families that often immigrate to this country. And that's why they come here, because they're like, it's the land of opportunity. If I work hard, yeah, you know, it's passed along generationally. And someone who is empathetic as you are, it sounds like the mental health or the medical field was the perfect path for you. Is that, this seemed like it was a calling for you. Do you think the fact that it was a calling for you is what made comedy on the back burner a hobby and less of a, I'm going to work as hard as I can so I no longer have to do this job, that I can focus only on comedy? Do you think it's because of your calling to be someone that is an advocate for people with mental health issues?
Well, I care deeply about it, about this work, but I'm really of retirement age. And I'd really like to be more of a journeyman working comedian. I have done one person shows of an hour. I do one called Punchlines and Prozac. You know, I could really use a manager and an agent to get out there, to help me promote. And I've even written to medical schools and conventions saying, would you like a psychiatrist to do a routine and entertain the crowd?
I love that, because I thought about doing the same thing. I have, at age 34, I had two heart attacks and a stroke.
Oh, no, really? I'm so sorry.
It's all right. It's my family genetics of we're not supposed to live. But and also I talk openly about mental health on stage. I've been toying with creating a one-man show where I talk about all of my medical issues and how they counteract. And, of course, talking about, you have to talk about how the healthcare insurance, how that's all affected. And I haven't really put a whole one-man show together. There's little bits that I do in my act here and there. But it's honestly, majority of my comedy is a HIPAA violation. So I'm on the same page of like, hey, medical professionals would love these very obscure jokes about metoprolol medication.
But if you're talking about yourself, I mean, you're not violating anyone else's privacy, right?
Oh, no. Me telling my own, the joke is that I would call it HIPAA violation because I'm talking so much about my own medical issues. Yeah. That would be the joking title.
Okay. That's funny. As long as you don't mention the actual doctors.
No, I don't want to talk about other people's. Honestly, my comedy is about my favorite subject, me.
That's a great subject. That's a great subject. You are very well versed. You are qualified, eminently qualified to discuss that.
I am a historical expert in dead hair Dennisisms.
It's beautiful. Beautiful.
So you are actively, now you said you were at retirement age. Have you retired yet, or are you in the process of soon?
I had a private practice. It's very small. And I must be good because people are getting well and not coming back.
Why are you doing that? That's a good marker of success.
You know, they're cured. I just need to...
Social Security, I need to retire. I'm too good. Everyone's too happy.
That's right. That's right. I don't really. Everyone's very stable, and give them refills, and they don't even remember me now. That's gratitude. No, but anyway.
Don't worry. When you become famous, you're never going to forget the little people that you treated to get you where you are.
But I am hungry to find the next step. I would love to do a one-woman show. But, you know, I have written plays. It's not easy getting a production. You usually have to fund it yourself. I did a show in the United Solo Theater Festival in 2012. I like the solo show format. Maybe that's the next step. I'm not sure. But I feel I need some collaborators to help out.
I love that you're that we're talking while you're at the precipice of your next move in your career. That's because I can't wait to see what it's next. I love talking to people about their dreams and their visions and their hopes for the future of their careers. Like I am not white girl enough to be like, you need to manifest and put it out in the world. But you know what? This podcast is more than welcome to being your open spoken vision board of your future.
That's very kind. And given that permission, I don't know. I'd love to write a sitcom or have a Zoom show where people can come in and ask their questions, psychiatric questions. And they can, you know, they don't have to give their names. They can block their video. And it could be a place where people could listen in and learn something from someone else's question. But we wouldn't, but you know, you have to be careful. You have to be careful with it. Anyway, but there might be a way to do that. A mental health show that's entertaining and informative. And we would have disclaimers like this. We'll give you the best information we have, but this is not a substitute for your own care. And if you're suicidal, go to the nearest emergency room.
As someone who works in the medical field, do you watch like reality TV medical shows like Celebrity Therapy with Dr. Drew or Loveline? Or are you capable of watching any of those shows? I don't. I grew up on Loveline and I love Dr. Drew Pinsky.
I enjoyed them too. I thought Dr. Drew was great.
Yeah, I mean, he's in a little bit of a particular place because of COVID and people misunderstanding what his ideas of COVID was. But, and then Adam Carolla's, you know, his mouth is getting him in all the trouble that he loves to handle. But is there any of them out there that you watch and you're like, oh, I can't, this is all wrong, this is all theater? Or is there any that you're like, this is bad for the industry?
Well, there was a show.
I know we've talked so positively. Now I'm like, hey, all right, let's dish and talk trash about certain shows.
Well, you mean like fictional scripted shows like New Amsterdam or Grey's Anatomy?
Sure. If those,
they're too good looking.
Look, I vented. Please vet.
They're all too
vetch,
good
come on.
No, they're all too good looking. Nobody's that good looking at 3 a.m. when you're on call. The lighting is too good. You ever been in an ER? It's the worst lighting, the fluorescent lighting. Everybody looks like a zombie. All these people, they're beautifully coiffed and made up, and they're slim and trim and have beautiful toned yoga bodies. I mean, come on. Ellen Pompeo? Really? Anyway.
None of them have the kind of body that says, I've been eating all my nutrition from a vending machine for 6 days straight. Awesome. So what was your experience with the documentary By Day, By Night? We just recently had your producer and writer,
Claudia,
of the documentary, Claudia, on the podcast. And that's why we were able to connect with you, was through Claudia.
Yes.
So what was your experience with
someone who
changed your name? We talked earlier that you wanted to hide away from your patients with your name. Now there's a documentary that shows your face and puts your name out there.
Have you seen it yet? I hope you get a chance to see it sometime.
Yes, I got to see a screener of it.
Yeah. So it was a wonderful experience. Getting to meet the other comedians was very eye-opening, and to learn about their lives and careers and challenges, especially Mitch Shapiro, who has this syndrome, Usher syndrome, where he has, you know, it's all in the film, but he has visual and hearing impairment. Or Bernie, who... the missionary lady, missioner. Mm-hmm. And it's just, people have done what I did. And I was very happy to meet them through this film. Like, found stand-up as a lifeline. And that's not overstating it. A way, I think without stand-up, I'm not sure I would have been able to stay working as a psychiatrist, because you need something. I needed something, you know, that was uplifting and fun and a chance to be myself and reveal some parts of myself in a way that you can't in the job. Nobody, you know, being a doctor, you really learn to wear a professional mask. It's almost like an acting job, and you have to be professional. Everything you say, there's so much scrutiny. Everything you write, you know, you can't be a goofball. You can't be a cut up. But I needed a place where I could be silly and foolish and take a pratfall and be ridiculous and lose my dignity. And that's been a lot of fun, because we are all things. You know, we have different sides. But anyway, getting back to the documentary, Claudia gave us each so much time on screen to talk about ourselves and even illustrate our lives. She did what I'd call a deep dive into the five subjects. The fellow that's the court officer, he has an autistic son. He brings his son to all his performances. So he has created something apart from his 9-to-5 job that's beautiful, that includes his family and gives him, he's so funny. His material's great. I mean, it was a pleasure meeting all these people and an honor to be part of this. And Claudia is just, well, she's a dynamo. She's an extraordinary person, a loving, creative, and brilliant person, one of the most amazing people I've ever met.
Excellent. And where can people find the comedy of Ellen Orchid?
YouTube. Just type in Ellen Orchid. I have a lot of clips up there. And I have a website, ellenorchid.com. And I will be posting upcoming gigs on that very soon.
And on the social medias, Ellen Orchid as well.
Oh, yes, yes.
O-R-C-H-I-D. Just like the plant that is very difficult to keep growing. I know. I worked in a garden for a little while.
Did you really?
Yeah, in college. That's how I paid for college, working at Home Depot selling plants.
Good for you. Good for you. That's
excellent.
Resourceful.
Ellen, it was great having you on. I'm glad we got the time
Thank
to
you.
Talk.
And thank you, Dennis.
That we got to talk openly about mental health and the necessary need for more of it. So thanks so much.
Thank you. Thanks a million.
Getting sick of living in a box. In a box. I wanna poke some holes in the top.